the execution of people by hanging, electrocution, gassing, shooting, or garrotting. What's that? A kind of strangling they have mostly in Spain. They asked me to write it on the board. They scribbled it in their notebooks, and I make a mental note that if ever a class dragged, I turn immediately to the various methods of execution. Vivian from Haiti raises her hand. That's wrong, that executing, but I think it's okay for the other thing, the one about the babies, oh yeah, the abortion, they should be shot. All right, Vivian, why don't you write that in your research paper? Me? Write down what I'm saying? Who cares what I'm saying? I'm nobody, Professor, nobody. Their faces are blank. They don't understand. How could they? What's this about the other side of the story? Nobody ever told them they had a right to an opinion. They're not shy about speaking up in class, but putting words on paper is a dangerous step, especially when you grow up in Spanish or French. Besides, they don't have time for all this. They've got kids to raise and jobs, and they have to send money to their families back in Haiti and Cuba. It's easy for professors to give all these assignments, but man, there's another world out there, and God only put 24 hours in the day. There are 10 minutes left in the hour, and I tell the class they should feel free now to explore the library. No one moves. They don't even whisper anymore. They sit in their winter overcoats. They clutch book bags and wait till that exact second when the hour ends. In the hallway, I tell my friend, veteran Professor Herbert Miller, of my problems with this class. He says, they work days and nights. They come to class, they sit and listen, they do their best. These people in the admissions office let them in. Then they expect the teacher to perform a miracle or be the hatchet man. I'm not going to be the enforcer for the front office. Research? How can these people do research papers when they still struggle to read the damn newspaper? The class would agree with Miller. They'd nod and say, yeah, yeah. They think they're nobody. That was something I should have known all along. The people in my classes, adults from 18 to 62, thought their opinions did not matter. Whatever ideas they had came from the avalanche of media in our world. No one had ever told them they had a right to think for themselves. I told them, you have a right to think for yourselves. Silence in the classroom. I said, you don't have to swallow everything I tell you, or what anyone tells you. You can ask questions. If you don't have the answer, we can look it up in the library or discuss it here. They look at one another. Yeah. The man is talking funny. Tells us we don't have to believe him. Hey, we came here to learn English so as we can pass. We gotta graduate. I want to be the great liberating teacher. To raise them from their knees after days of drudgery in offices and factories. To help them cast off their shackles, to lead them to the mountaintop, to breathe the air of freedom. Once their minds were cleared of cant, they'd see me as savior. For the people in this class, life was hard enough, without having an English teacher preaching about thinking and bothering them with questions. Man, we just want to get through this place. The research papers turned out to be an ecstasy of plagiarism. Articles on Papa Doc Duvalier and Fidel Castro, lifted from encyclopedias. Vivian's paper on Toussaint Louverture rambled on for 17 pages in English and Haitian French, and I gave it a B+ for the labor of copying and typing. I tried to redeem myself with a comment on the title page to the effect that Toussaint thought for himself and suffered for it, and I hope Vivian might follow his example, though not to the suffering part. When I returned the papers, I tried to say positive things about them to encourage the authors to dig into their subjects even more. I was talking to myself. It was the last class of the year, and they were looking at their watches, ignoring me. I walked to the subway dejected and angry with myself for not having made some kind of connection with them. Four women from the class waited on the subway platform. They smiled and asked if I lived in Manhattan. No, I got two stops in Brooklyn. I didn't know what to say after that. No chit-chat, no banter from the professor. Vivian said, thanks for the grade, Mr. McCourt. That's the highest I ever got in English. And you know, you're a pretty good teacher. The others nodded and smiled, and I knew they were just being nice. When the train came in, they said, "See you," and hurried along the platform. My college teaching career ended in a year. The department chairman said that even though there was brisk competition for my job and applications from people with PhDs, he'd stretch the rules, but if I wanted to stay, I'd need to show evidence I was pursuing a degree on the doctoral level. I told him I wasn't pursuing anything. "Sorry," said the chairman. "Oh, it's all right," I said, and went searching for another high school teaching job. Alberta said I was going nowhere in life, and I congratulated her on her astuteness. She said, "Cut out the sarcasm. We've been married for 6 years, and all you do is meander from one school to another. If you don't settle down to something very soon, you'll be 40 and wondering where your life went." She pointed to people all around us, happily married, productive, settled, content, having children, developing mature relationships, looking to the future, going on nice vacations, joining clubs, taking up golf, growing old together, visiting relatives, dreaming of grandchildren, supporting their churches, thinking of retirement. I agreed with her, but I couldn't admit it. I gave her a sermon on life in America. I told her life was an adventure, and maybe I was living in the wrong century. I should have lived back in the days of the Conestoga wagon, when the wagon master in Western movies, John Wayne, Randolph Scott, Joel McRae, cracked his whip and called, "Move out!" And the studio orchestra went into raptures. 50 violins swelling with prairie patriotism, pure wagon train music, violins and banjos welcoming the harmonica wail, men in wagon driver seats going hup, 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 or men walking, leading horses and oxen, with wives up there holding reins. Some wives you can see are pregnant, and you know, because you've been here before, they'll have their babies in the middle of an attack by ferocious Apache, Sioux, Cheyenne. They'll get the wagons in a circle and fight off those howling braves, threatening nice white mothers in labor. But still, those Indians are magnificent in their feathers, on their horses. And you know the Indians would be driven off because every white man, woman, and child, even in labor, would blaze away with rifle and revolver, will swing rolling pins and frying pans, defeat the pesky redskin so that the wagon train can move on again, so that white people will conquer this wild continent, so that the expansion of America will not be stopped by locust, drought, Rocky Mountains, or the whooping Apache. I said that was the part of American history I loved. She said, "Oh, Conestoga wagon my ass, go get a job." And I snapped right back with a line from Dylan Thomas, "A job is death without dignity." She said, "You'll have your dignity, but you won't have me." You could see there was little hope for the future of that marriage. The head of the academic department at Fashion Industries High School did not like me, but there was a teacher shortage. No one wanted to teach in vocational high schools, and there I was, available, and with McKee experience. He sat behind his desk, ignored my hand, told me he ran a dynamic department, rolled his shoulders like a boxer to suggest great energy and determination. He said the kids in Fashion High School were not academic hotshots, but decent kids learning useful trades like tailoring and cutting, shoemaking, upholstery, and damn it, there was nothing wrong with that, eh? They'd be valuable members of society, and I should never make the mistake of looking down my nose at kids in vocational high schools. I told him I had just spent 8 years in a vocational high school, wouldn't dream of looking down my nose at anyone. "Oh, yeah? Which school?" "McKee, on Staten Island." He sniffed. "Well, that doesn't have much of a reputation, does it?" I needed that job and didn't want to offend him. I told him if I knew anything about teaching, I learned it at McKee. He said, "Well, we'll see." I wanted to tell him shove his job up his arse, but that would be the end of my teaching career. It was clear my future was not in the school. I wondered if I had a future anywhere in the school system. He said 4 teachers in his department were taking courses in supervision and administration, and I shouldn't be surprised to see them one day in high positions in schools around the city. We don't sit on our asses here, he said. We move on and up. And what are your long-range plans?
I don't know.
I suppose I just came here to be a teacher, I said. He shook his head, couldn't understand my lack of ambition. I wasn't dynamic enough. Because of him, those four teachers taking courses were moving on and up and out. That's what he said. Why should they spend their lives in the classroom with kids when they could travel the corridors of power? I felt brave for a moment and asked him, if everyone moved on and up and out, who would teach the children? He ignored me, allowed himself a little smile with a mouth that had no lips. I lasted one term, September to January, before he forced me out. It may have been the matter of the shoeless and the rolled-up magazine, or it may have been my lack of dynamism and ambition. Still, he praised me at a department meeting for my lesson on the parts of a sentence, where I used the ballpoint pen as a visual aid. This is the plastic tube that holds the ink. If you remove this tube from the pen, what would happen? My students look at me as if they can't believe I'm asking such a dumb-ass question. Man, you wouldn't be able to write. Okay, now what is this I'm holding in my hand? Again, the patient look. That's a spring, man. And what would happen if we removed the spring? When you try to push the tube out, it won't write because there's no spring to push it and keep its little nose out there where all the writing is done, and then you get in a lot of trouble because you can't write your homework. The teacher's going to think you're crazy if you come in telling him about missing springs or tubes. Now look what I'm writing on the board. The spring makes the pen work. What's the subject of this sentence? In other words, what are we talking about in this sentence? The pen. No, no, no. There's an action word here. It's called a verb. What is it? Oh, yeah, the spring. No, no, no. The spring is a thing. Yeah, yeah, the spring is a thing. Hey, man, that's poetry. So what does the spring do? It makes the pen work. Good. The spring performs the action. We're talking about the spring, right? They looked doubtful. Suppose we say, the pen makes the spring work. Would that be right? No, the spring makes the pen work. Anyone could see that. So, what is the action word? Makes. Right. And what word uses the action word? Spring. So you can see how a ballpoint pen is like a sentence. It needs something to make it work. It needs action, a verb. Can you see that? They said they could. The chairman, making notes in the back of the room, looked puzzled. At our post-observation conference, he said he could understand the connection I was making between structure of pen and structure of sentence. He wasn't sure if I'd succeeded in getting that across to the kids, but still, it was imaginative and innovative. He was sure, ha-ha, if some of his senior English teachers tried it, they'd improve on it, but it was a pretty nifty idea. When I pulled on the shoelace one morning and it broke, I said, shit. Alberta mumbled into the pillow. What's the matter? I broke the shoelace. You're always breaking shoelaces. No, I'm not always breaking shoelaces. I haven't broken a shoelace in years. If you didn't pull on them, they wouldn't break. What the hell are you talking about? That shoelace was 2 years old, out in all kinds of weather, and why wouldn't it break? I pulled on it the way you try to force bureau drawers when they stick. No, I don't force bureau drawers. Yes, you do. You get into your Puritan Yankee rage as if the drawers were your enemy. At least I don't break them. No, you're just yanking them so hard they're stuck forever and you have to pay a master carpenter a fortune to straighten them. If we didn't have such cheap furniture, I wouldn't have to struggle with drawers. Jesus, I should have listened to my friends who warned me against marrying Irishmen. I could never win a domestic squabble. She would never stick to the subject, which in this case was shoelaces and bureau drawers. No, She had to drag in the Irish thing, the closing argument, the one you made before you sentenced the defendant to be hanged. I headed for school in a rage, in no mood for teaching or cajoling. Oh, come on, Stan. Sit down, Joanna. Put your makeup away, please. Are you listening? Open your copy of this magazine, Practical English. Turn to page 9, the vocabulary quiz. Fill in the blank spaces, and then we'll go over your answers. They said, yeah, yeah, yeah. Keep the teacher happy. They lifted magazine pages as if each weighed a ton. They took their time. Turning to page 9 was a big deal, and before they made that move, they had things to discuss with their friends in front, behind, beside them. They might have to talk about what they watched on TV last night. God, wasn't that scary? And did you know Miriam? Yeah, the one in our drawing class is pregnant. Did you know that? No, I didn't know that. Wow, who's the father? You won't believe it. Swear you won't tell. It's that new social studies teacher. Really? I thought he was a fag. Nah, that's a big act. Would you open the magazine to page 9? 15 minutes into the class, and they're still turning pages of lead. Hector, open the magazine to page 9. He had straight black hair and a thin, intensely white face. He stared straight ahead as if he hadn't heard me. Hector, open the magazine. He shook his head. I walked toward him, holding a rolled-up copy of Practical English. Hector, the magazine. Open it. He shook his head again. I slapped him across the face with the magazine. There was a red mark on that white cheek. He jumped up. Drop dead, he said, tears in his voice. He walked toward the door and I called after him. Sit down, Hector. But he was gone. I wanted to run after him, tell him I was sorry, but I let him go. When he cooled down a bit, and I collected my wits, I might be able to talk to him. I dropped the magazine on my desk and sat there for the rest of the period, staring ahead like Hector. The class made no pretense of turning to page 9. They looked at me or one another or out the window, and they were quiet. Should I talk to them? Tell them how sorry I was? No, no. Teachers don't stand there confessing to mistakes. Teachers don't admit their ignorance. We waited for the bell, and when they filed out, Sophia, the girl who sat next to Hector, said, "You shouldn't have done that. You're a nice man, which you shouldn't have, and Hector is nice too. Hector, he got out of trouble, and now you made it worse." Now the class would despise me, especially the Cubans, Hector's group. There were 13 Cubans, the largest ethnic group in the class. They considered themselves superior to any other Spanish-speaking group and every Friday wore white shirts, blue ties, and black pants to make sure they weren't confused with any other group, especially the Puerto Ricans. It was the middle of September, and if I didn't find a way of getting the Cubans back, they'd make my life a misery till the end of the term in January. At lunch, a guidance counselor brought his tray to my table. "Hi. What happened with you and Hector?" I told him. He nodded. "Too bad. I wanted him in your class because of the ethnic thing." "What ethnic thing? He's Cuban. I'm Irish." "He's only half Cuban. His mother's name is Considine, but he's ashamed of it. So why would you put him in my class?" I know it sounds like a song, but his mother was a high-class whore in Havana. He had questions about the Irish, and I thought they might come up in your class. Besides, he has gender problems. Looks like a boy to me. Yeah, but, you know, there's the homosexual thing. He thinks now you hate homosexuals, and he says, fine, he's going to hate all the Irish, and all his Cuban friends will hate all the Irish. No, that's not right. He has no Cuban friends. They call him Maricon and stay away from him. His family is ashamed of him. Oh, hell. He defied me. Wouldn't open the magazine. I don't want to be caught in a sex and ethnic war. Melvin asked me to meet with him and Hector in the guidance office. "Hector, Mr. McCourt wants to come to an understanding with you." "I don't care what Mr. McCourt wants. I don't want to sit in class with no Irishmen. They drink, hit people for no reason." "Hector, You didn't open your magazine when I told you. He stared at me with cold black eyes. So, you don't open your magazine and teacher slaps your face? Well, you ain't no teacher. My mother was a teacher. Your mother was... I almost said it. But he was gone. Second time he walked out on me. Melvin shook his head and shrugged, and I knew my days at Fashion Industries High School were over. Melvin said Hector could sue me for assault, and if he did, my ass was in a sling. He tried to be funny. If you want to slap kids around, go get a job in a Catholic school. Those big priests and brothers, even the nuns, are still beating up the kids. Maybe you'll be happier with them. Of course the chairman heard about my problem with Hector. He said nothing till term's end when he placed a letter in my mailbox saying there would not be a position for me in the coming term. He wished me well and would be pleased to give me a satisfactory rating. When I met him in the hall, he said that with regard to the satisfactory rating, he might have been bending the truth a little, ha-ha. Still, if I kept at it, I might succeed as a teacher because in his observations he noticed that occasionally I had hit pedagogical pay dirt. He smiled and you could see he liked his little phrase. He said something about the lesson where I illustrated the parts of a sentence by breaking down a ballpoint pen. Yeah, I had hit pedagogical pay dirt. Alberta said they were looking for a teacher at her high school, Sewer Park, on the Lower East Side. The main building was overcrowded, and I was assigned to an annex, an abandoned elementary school by the East River. My teenagers complained about the discomfort and indignity of squeezing their growing bodies into baby furniture. This was a melting pot school, Jewish, Chinese, Puerto Rican, Greek, Dominican, Russian, Italian, and I had no preparation or training for teaching English as a second language. Kids want to be cool. Never mind what parents say or adults in general. Kids want to hang out and talk street language. They want to swear eloquently. You can curse and swear, and you are a man, man. And if you're hanging out and this foxy white chick comes along the sidewalk, you can look cool as shit, man. But if you don't got the words, or you got some kind of crazy foreign accent, she ain't gonna give you even a look, and you are home, man, playing with yourself, and pissed off because English is a bitch of a language that makes no sense, and you'll never learn it. You're in America, and you gotta get with it, man. So, teacher man, forget your highfalutin English literature and get down here to brass tacks. Back to C-A-T, cat man. Speak the speech, and speak it slowly, slowly. The bell rings, and I'm hearing the Tower of Babel. Excuse me. They ignore me. Or they don't understand my mild request. Again. Excuse me! A big, red-haired Dominican boy catches my eye. Teacher! You want I should help? He climbs up on his desk and everyone cheers because climbing on desks is strictly forbidden by the authorities, and here is Red Oscar defying the authorities right there in the presence of a teacher. Yo, says Oscar. Mira. There is a chorus of Miras. Mira, 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 till Oscar raises his hand and yells, Yo, shut up. Listen to teacher. Thanks, Oscar. But would you please climb down? A hand. So, mister, what's your name? I write on the board, Mr. McCourt, and pronounce it. Hey, mister, you Jewish? No. All the teachers in the school Jewish. How come you're not Jewish? I don't know. They look surprised, even astonished, and the look travels the room. The look says, you hear that, Miguel? Teacher up there, he don't know. It's a hot moment. Teacher confesses ignorance, and the class is shocked into silence. Off with the mask, teacher man, and what a relief. No more Mr. Know-it-all. A few years earlier, I could have been one of them, part of the huddled masses. This is my immigrant comfort level. I know English, but I'm not so far removed from their confusions. Rock bottom in the social hierarchy. I could drop the teacher mask, walk down the aisle, sit with them, and ask them about their families. What it was like in the old country, tell them about myself, my meandering days, How I hid for years behind the mask, still hiding as a matter of fact. How I wish we could lock that door and shut out the world till they spoke enough English to make them feel so cool they can tell that foxy white chick they're ready for a little action. Wouldn't that be pretty? I look at this collection of kids from all continents, faces of all colors and shapes, God's plenty, this garden. Asians with hair blacker and shinier than anything ever seen in Europe, the great brown eyes of Hispanic boys and girls, shyness of some, rowdiness of others, posturing of boys, coyness of girls. Nancy Chu asks if she can talk to me after the last class of the day. She sits at her desk and waits for the room to empty. She reminds me she's in my second period sophomore class. I'm here 3 years from China. Your English is very good, Nancy. Thank you. I learned English from Fred Astaire. Fred Astaire? I know all the songs from his movies. My favorite is Top Hat. I sing his songs all the time. My parents think I'm crazy. My friends, too. All they know is rock. And you can't learn English from rock. I have trouble with my parents all the time over Fred Astaire. Well, it's unusual, Nancy. Also, I watch you teach. Oh? And I wonder why you're so uptight. You know, so you should be cool. Kids all say if they knew English, they'd be so cool. Sometimes you're not uptight, and the kids like that. They like it when you tell stories and sing. When I'm uptight, I sing Dancing in the Dark. You should learn that, Mr. McCourt, and sing it to the class. You don't have such a bad voice. Nancy, I'm here to teach English. I'm not a song and dance man. Could you tell me how to be an English teacher who won't be uptight? But what will your parents say? They think I'm crazy already. And they say they're sorry they ever brought me from China where there's no Fred Astaire. They say I'm not even Chinese anymore. They say, what's the use of coming all the way from China just to be a teacher and listen to Fred Astaire? Could have been a teacher over there. You come here to make money, my parents say. Mr. McCourt, will you tell me how to be an English teacher? I will, Nancy. Thanks, Mr. McCourt. Do you mind if I ask questions in class? In class, she says, you were lucky you knew English when you came to America. How did you feel when you came to America? Confused. Do you know what confused means? The word goes around the room. They explain it to one another in their own languages and heads nod, yeah, yeah. They're surprised the man up there, the teacher, was once confused like them. And he knew English and everything. So, we have something in common. Confusion. I tell them that when I came to New York, I had trouble with language and the names of things. I had to learn food words. Sauerkraut, coleslaw, hot dog, bagel mit schmear. Then I tell them about my very first teaching experience, which had nothing to do with schools. Years before I became a teacher, I worked in a hotel. Big George, a Puerto Rican cook, said five kitchen workers were trying to learn English and would pay 50 cents each if I teach them words once a week during lunch hour. $2.50 for an hour. At the end of the month, I'd have $12.50, the most money I ever made at one time in my life. They wanted to know the names of things in the kitchen because if you don't know the names of things in English, how can you move up in the world? They'd hold up items and I'd name them and spell them out on sheets of paper. They laughed, shook their heads, when I couldn't name that flat thing with a handle, a spatula, the first one in my life. Big George laughed with his great belly quivering, and told the kitchen workers that was a spatula. They wanted to know how come I spoke English, if I came from a foreign country that wasn't England. And I had to explain how Ireland was conquered, how the English bullied us and tormented us until we spoke their language. When I talked about Ireland, there were words they didn't understand, and I wondered if there should be an extra charge for explaining them, or could I charge only for words connected with the kitchen? No, I couldn't charge them after the way they looked sad when I talked about Ireland and the way they said CCC, pat on my shoulder and offer me bites of their sandwiches. They understood because they were conquered too, first by the Spaniards, then the Americans, conquered so much they didn't know who they were, didn't know if they were black or white or Indian, or all three rolled into one. And that's hard to explain to your kids because they want to be one thing, not three things. And that's why they were here mopping up and washing pots and pans in this greasy kitchen. Big George said, "This ain't no greasy kitchen, so wash your mouth." They said, "Hell with you," and everyone laughed, even Big George, because the idea of talking like that to the biggest Puerto Rican in New York was so crazy. He laughed himself and gave everyone huge slices from a cake left over from the big lunch upstairs of the Daughters of the British Empire. After 4 lessons and $10, there was nothing left in the kitchen for me to name till Eduardo, who planned to climb in the world, began to ask questions about food and cooking in general. "How about braise?" he said. "How about sauté?" "Yeah, and marinate." I'd never heard of these words. And I looked at Big George to see if he could help, but he said he wasn't telling nobody nothing long as I was hauling in the big money for being the big-ass word expert. He knew I was in over my head with these new words, especially when they asked me the difference between pasta and risotto. I offered to go to the library and look them up, but they said they could do that themselves, and what were they paying me for? I could have told them you can't look up something in the library if you can't read English in the first place, but that didn't occur to me. I was nervous I might lose my new income, $2.50 a week. They said they didn't mind if I slipped up that time over the spatula. They gave me the money anyway, but they weren't going to hand over big bucks to a guy from a foreign country who didn't know pasta from risotto. 2 said they were sorry they were dropping out, and 3 said they'd hang on, hoping I'd help with words like braise and sauté. I tried to excuse myself by claiming these were French words, and surely they wouldn't expect me to know anything but English. One of the 3 patted my shoulder and hoped I wouldn't let them down, as they wanted to rise in the world of the kitchen. They had wives and children and girlfriends all waiting for them to rise and bring home more money, so I could see how much depended on me and my knowledge of words. Big George talked in a rough way to hide how soft he was. When the 5 Puerto Ricans were not in the kitchen, he taught me names of vegetables and fruits I'd never heard of: artichoke, asparagus, tangerine, persimmon, rutabaga. He barked the names at me and made me nervous, but I knew he wanted me to know. That's how I felt about the Puerto Ricans. I wanted them to know words, and I almost forgot about the money when they were able to recite what I taught them. Made me feel superior. And I thought, this must be the way a teacher feels. Then the 2 dropouts caused problems in the locker room where we changed and washed up. They knew the word for locker, but now they wanted to know what was that thing we sat on, the bench, and what was that flat thing in the locker where you place small items, the shelf? That was clever, the way they got these words out of me free of charge. They'd point to the string in a shoe, and I'd tell them it was a lace, and they'd smile and say, "Gracias, gracias." They were getting something for nothing, and I didn't mind till one of the 3 paying Puerto Rican said, "What for you tell these words for nothing we pay, eh? What for?" I told them these locker room words had nothing to do with kitchens and rising in the world, but they say they didn't give a shit. They were paying me and didn't see why the dropout should get the free words. These were the last words in English they spoke in the locker room that day. The 3 screamed at the 2 in Spanish, and the 2 screamed back at the 3, and there was a banging of locker doors and 5 middle fingers stabbing the air till Big George roared in and yelled at them in Spanish, and they cut it out. I was sorry over that big row in the locker room and wanted to make it up to the 3 paying ones. I tried to slip them free words like carpet, bulb, dustpan, broom, but they said they didn't care anymore, that I should take my dustpan and shove it up my ass. And where did I say I was from? Ireland. Yeah, see. Well, I'm going back to PR. Don't like English no more. Too hard. Hurts my throat. Big George said, "Hey, Irishman, not your fault. You hell of a good teacher. All you guys come to the kitchen for a piece of peach pie." But we never had the pie because Big George had a heart attack and collapsed on an open flame on the stove, and they said you could smell his flesh burning. Nancy has this dream of taking her mother to a Fred Astaire movie because her mother never goes out and she's a very intelligent woman. Her mother can quote Chinese poetry, especially Li Po. You ever heard of Li Po, Mr. McCourt?
No.
She tells the class the reason her mother loves Li Po is that he died in a most beautiful way. One bright moonlit night, he drank rice wine and took his boat out on the lake. And he was so moved by the beauty of the moon reflected in the lake, he leaned over the side to embrace it, and fell into the lake and drowned. Nancy's mother would have tears on her cheeks when she talked about this, and it was her dream, if ever things got better in China, to return and take a boat out on that lake. Nancy herself had tears when she talked about how her mother said if she got very old or had a very serious illness, she'd lean over the side and embrace the moon like her beloved Li Po. When the bell rings, they don't jump from their seats. They don't rush and scramble. They take their things and file out quietly. And I'm sure they have moon and lake images in their heads. In 1968 at Seward Park High School, I faced the hardest challenge of my whole teaching career. I had the usual five classes, three English as a second language and two regular ninth grade English classes. One of those ninth grade classes consisted of 29 black girls from an uptown feeder school and two Puerto Rican boys who sat in the corner minding their own business and never saying a word. If they opened their mouths, the girls would turn on them. Who asked you? All the ingredients of difficulty were wrapped up in this one group. Gender clash, generation clash, culture clash, racial clash. The girls ignored me. White guys standing up there trying to get their attention. They had stuff to talk about. There was always some adventure from last night. Boys, boys, boys. Serena said she didn't go out with boys. She went out with men. She had ginger hair, and her skin was the color of butterscotch. She was so thin, tight clothes hung loose on her. She was 15, and the center of the class, the one who settled arguments, the one who made decisions. She told the class one day, "I don't want to be no leader. You want to be with me? Okay, you can be with me." Some girls challenged her place in the class, tried to cross swords with her. "Hey, Serena, how come you go out with all men? They can't do nothing." "Yeah, they can. They can put $5 in my hand every time." They complained to me. "We don't do nothing in this class. Other classes do things." I brought in a tape recorder. Surely they'd like to hear themselves talking. Serena took the microphone. "My sister was arrested last night. My sister is a nice person. She was only liberating two pork chops in the store. White people take pork chops and everything all the time, but they don't get arrested. I seen white women walk out of the store with steaks under their dresses. Now my sister in jail till she got to court." She stopped, looked at me for the first time and handed back the microphone. "I don't know why I'm telling you this. You're just a teacher. You're just a white man." She turned away and walked to her seat. She sat primly, hands folded on the desk. She had put me in my place, and the class knew it. For the first time that term, the room was quiet. They waited for me to take the next step, but I was paralyzed, standing there with the microphone in my hand, the tape running from reel to reel, recording nothing. "Anyone else?" I said. They stared at me. Was that contempt? A hand went up. "Maria." The bright, well-dressed one who kept a neat notebook had a question. "Mister, how come the other classes go on trips and we don't go nowhere? We just sit here talking to a stupid tape recorder. How come?" Yeah, yeah, said the class. How come? Other classes go to the movies. Why can't we go to the movies? They were looking at me, talking to me, recognizing my existence, including me in their world. If you had walked into the room at that moment, you would have said, oh, here's a teacher actually engaging with his class. Look at those bright young girls and those two boys gazing at their teacher. It makes you believe in public education. So, I said, feeling like a man in charge, what movie would you like to see? Cold Turkey, said Maria. My brother seen it up on Broadway near Times Square. Nah, said Serena. That movie is all about drugs. Cold Turkey is when you just stop drugs. You don't go to no clinic and no doctor. Maria said her brother said nothing about drugs. Serena looked at the ceiling. Your brother goody-goody like you. Your brother don't know shit. Next day, they brought notes from their parents giving them permission to take a trip to see a movie. A dozen notes were forgeries written in the grand manner parents are supposed to use when addressing teachers. When the Puerto Rican boys brought no notes, the girls objected. How come they're not going to the movie? We brought notes and everything, and we have to go to this movie, and they have the day off. How come? To appease the girls, I told the boys they'd have to write a short report on how they spent their day. The girls say, yeah, yeah, and the boys look sullen. On the 6-block walk to the subway, the parade of 29 black girls and one white teacher attracted attention. Shopkeepers shouted at me to tell these kids, keep their goddamn hands off the goddamn goods. Can't you control these goddamn Negroes? They ran into stores to buy candy, hot dogs, and bottles of pink lemonade. They said pink lemonade was the greatest. And why couldn't they have it in the school cafeteria instead of all those juices that tasted like detergent or milk? Down the steps, into the subway, forget the fare, jumped the turnstiles, run through gates. Man in the change booth yelled, hey, hey, pay your fare, pay your goddamn fare. I held back, didn't want the man in the booth to know I was with that wild pack. They ran back and forth on the subway platform. Where's the train? I don't see no train. They pretended to push one another onto the tracks. Teacher, teacher, she tried to kill me. Teacher, you see that? People waiting for the train glared at me. A man said, why don't they go back uptown where they belong? They don't know how to behave like human beings. I wanted to be a brave, concerned, committed teacher, stand up to him, defend my 28 rowdy black girls. Maria the exception, Maria the forger. But I was a long way from bravery. What would I say anyway? You try it, Mr. Indignant Citizen. You try taking 29 black girls on the subway, all charged up with being 15 and escaping from school for a day, all pumped up with sugar from cookies, candy, and pink lemonade. Try teaching them every day when they look at you as if you're a white snowman about to melt. I said nothing and prayed for the rumble of the F train. On the train, they squealed and pushed and fought for seats. The passengers looked hostile. Why aren't these Negro kids in school? No wonder they're ignorant. At West 4th Street, an obese white woman waddled onto the train and stood with her back to the closing door. The girls stared at her and snickered. She stared back. What are you little bitches looking at? Serena had the smart, troublemaking mouth. She said, we never seen a mountain get on a train before. Her 28 classmates laughed, pretended to collapse, laughed again. Serena stared, unsmiling, at the large woman who said, come over here, honey, and I'll show you how a mountain can move. I was the teacher. I had to assert myself, but how? Then I had a strange feeling. I looked at the other passengers, their frowns of disapproval. And I wanted to fight back, defend my 29. I stood with my back to the large woman to keep Serena from coming near her. Her classmates chanted, go, Serena, go! The train pulled into the 14th Street station, and the large woman backed out the door. You're lucky I have to get off this train, honey, or I'd have you for breakfast. Serena sneered after her. Yeah, fatso, you really need breakfast. She moved as if to follow the woman, but I blocked the door and kept her on the train till we reached 42nd Street. The way she looked at me gave me a feeling of satisfaction and puzzlement. If I could win her over, I'd have the class. They'd say, "That's Mr. McCord. The teacher stopped Serena from getting into a fight with a white woman on the train. He's on our side. He's okay." Once they saw the pornography and sex shops along 42nd Street, it was impossible to keep them together. They hooted and giggled and postured like the half-naked figures in the shop windows. "Mr. McCord, Mr. McCord, can we go in?" "No, no, can't you see the signs? You have to be 21. Let's go." A policeman stood before me. "Yes, I'm their teacher." "So, what are these kids doing on 42nd Street in the middle of the day?" I blushed, embarrassed. "Going to a movie." "Well, isn't that something? Going to a movie. And that's what we pay taxes for. Okay, Mr. Teacher, keep these girls moving." "All right, girls," I said, "let's go. Straight ahead to Times Square." Maria walked beside me. She said, "You know, we never came to Times Square before." I wanted to hug her for talking to me, but all I could manage was, "Well, you should come here at night to see the lights." At the theater, they rushed to the ticket office, pushing one another aside. Five lingered near me, giving me sidelong looks. "What's the matter? Aren't you getting tickets?" They shuffled and looked away and said they had no money. I thought of saying, "Well, why the hell did you come here?" But I didn't want to spoil a budding relationship with them. Tomorrow, they might let me be a teacher. I bought the tickets, distributed them, hoped there might be a look or a thank you, nothing. They took the tickets, ran into the lobby, straight to the concession stand, with money they told me they didn't have, staggered upstairs with popcorn, candy, bottles of Coke. I followed them to the balcony, where they pushed and fought for seats and disturbed the other customers. An usher complained to me, "We can't have this." And I told the girls, "Please sit down and be quiet." They ignored me. There were a tight pack of 29 black girls at Loose in the World, raucous, defiant, flinging bits of popcorn at one another, shouting up at the projection booth, "Hey, when are we going to see the movie? We're not going to live forever." The projectionist said, "If they're not quiet, I might have to call management." I said, "Yes, I want to be here when management comes. I want to see management handle them." But the lights dimmed, and the movie came on, and my 29 girls grew silent. The opening shot showed a perfect small American town. Sweet tree-lined avenues, blonde white children scooting along on little bicycles, with cheerful background music to assure us that all was well in this American paradise. And from the front row of the balcony came an agonized cry from one of my 29 girls. "Hey, Mr. McCord, how come you taking us to these honky movies?" They complained all through the movie. The usher shone his flashlight on them and threatened them with management. I pleaded with them, "Girls, please be quiet. Management is on its way." They turned it into a chant. "Mangament on it way. Mangament on it way. Hi-ho the daddy, yo. Mangament on it way." They said management could kiss their ass, and that upset the usher. He said, "Okay, that's it. That's IT it. You don't behave yourself and you're out. O-U-T. Oh, man. He know how to spell and everything. Okay, we be quiet." When the movie ended and the lights came on, no one moved. "All right," I said. "Let's go. It's over." "We know it's over. We not blind. You have to go home now." They said they were staying. They were going to see this hunky movie again. I told them I was leaving. "Okay, you're leaving." They turned away to wait for their second viewing of Cold Turkey, that boring, hunky movie. The following week, the 29 girls said, "Is that all we're going to do? No more trips. Just sit here every day talking about nouns and you making us write that stuff you put on the board. That all?" A note in my mailbox announced a trip for our students to a college production of Hamlet on Long Island. I threw the announcement into the waste paper basket. 29 girls, who could sit through two performances of Cold Turkey would never appreciate Hamlet. Next day, more questions. How come all these other classes go on a big trip to see a play? Well, it's a play by Shakespeare. Yeah, so? How could I tell them the truth? That I had such low expectations of them, I thought they'd never understand a word of Shakespeare. I said it was a hard play to understand, and I didn't think they'd like it. Oh yeah, so what's it about, this play? It's called Hamlet. It's about a prince who comes home and is shocked to discover his father is dead, and his mother already married to his father's brother. I know what happened, said Serena. The class called out, what happened, what happened? Brother that married the mother tries to kill the prince, right? Yes, but that comes later. Serena gave me the look that said she was trying to be patient. Course it comes later. Everything comes later. If everything came at the beginning, then there's nothing to come later. Donna said, what you talking about? None of your business talking to the teacher about the prince. A fight was brewing. I had to stop it. I said, Hamlet was angry about his mother marrying his uncle. They said, wow. Hamlet thought his uncle killed his father. Didn't I say that already, said Serena. What's the use me saying something if you're going to say it too? We still want to know how come we're not going to see this play. White kids going to see this play just because this prince be white. All right. I'll see if we can go with the other classes. They lined up to board the bus. They told passing pedestrians and motorists that were going to Long Island to see this play about a woman who marries her dead husband's brother. The Puerto Rican boys asked if they could sit near me. They didn't want to sit with these girls who were crazy and talk nonstop about sex and everything. Soon as the bus pulled into the street, the girls were opening bags and sharing lunch. They whispered about the one who'd get a prize for hitting the bus driver with a piece of bread. They'd all contribute a dime, and the winner would get $2.80. But he was watching in his rearview mirror and told them, just try it, go ahead, just try it, and your little black ass will be off this bus. The girl said, oh yeah, in that brave, cheeky way. That's all they could say because the driver was black, and they knew with him they'd get away with nothing. At the college, a man with a bullhorn announced teachers were expected to keep their classes together. The assistant principal from my school told me they were relying on me to keep order in my class. That class had a reputation, he said. I led them into the auditorium and stood in the aisle while they pushed and shoved and argued over seats. The Puerto Rican boys asked if they could sit far away. When Serena called them spick and span, the girls went into fits of giggling that didn't stop till the ghost of Hamlet's father appeared and terrified everyone. The ghost appeared on stilts draped in black, and the girls oohed and aahed. When the spotlight dimmed on him and he disappeared into the wings, Claudia, sitting beside me, called out, "Oh, he's so cute. Where he going? He coming back, teacher?" "Yes, he is," I said, embarrassed by whispered shushings from serious people all over the auditorium. She applauded each time the ghost appeared, whimpered when he left. "I think he's so cool. I want him back," she said. When the play ended and the cast took their bows, there was no ghost. She stood and called to the stage, "Where's the ghost? I want the ghost. Where is the ghost?" The other 28 stood and called for the ghost till an actor left the stage and the ghost reappeared immediately. The 29 applauded and cheered, and they said they wanted to go out with him. The ghost removed his black hat and cloak to show he was just an ordinary college student and not worth making a fuss over. The 29 gasped and complained the whole play was a trick, especially that phony ghost up there. And they promised they'd never go to a phony play like this again, not even if they had to sit in class with that Mr. McCourt and his spelling and stuff, not even if all the other classes in the school were going. On the way home, they fell asleep, all except Serena, who sat behind the bus driver. When she asked if he had any children, he said he couldn't talk and drive at the same time. It was against the law. But yes, he had children, and he didn't want any of them to be a bus driver. He was working to send them to good schools, and if they didn't do what they were told, he'd break their ass. He said you had to work harder in this country when you were black, but in the end, that made you stronger. When you have to push harder and climb harder, you develop muscles, and then no one can stop you. Serena said she'd like to be a hairdresser, but the bus driver said, "You can do better than that. You want to stand there the rest of your life fixing hair for cranky old women. You're smart. You can go to college." "Yeah? Do you really think I can go to college?" "Why not? You look intelligent enough and you talk good, so why not?" "Nobody never told me that before." "Well, I'm telling you, and don't sell yourself short." "Okay," said Serena. "Okay," said the bus driver. He smiled at her in his rear-view mirror, and I suppose she smiled back at him. I couldn't see her face. He was a bus driver, and black, and the way she confided in him made me think about the waste of human beings in the world. Next day, Claudia wants to know, "How come everybody be picking on the girl?" "Ophelia?" "Yeah. Everybody be picking on that poor girl, and she's not even black. How come? Guy that makes all the speeches has a sword to fight people, so nobody pushes him in the river." "Hamlet?" "Yeah, and you know what?" "What?" "He was so mean to his mom, and he a prince and everything. Why didn't she just get up and slap his face? Why?" Serena, the bright one, raises her hand like an ordinary kid in an ordinary class. I stare at the hand. I'm sure she's going to ask for the lavatory pass. She says, "Hamlet's mom is a queen. Queens don't act like everyone else, slapping people around. You a queen, you gotta have dignity." She looks at me in that direct way that's almost a challenge. Eyes wide and beautiful and unblinking. A hint of a smile. This thin, black 15-year-old knows her power. I feel myself blushing. And that starts another round of giggling. The following Monday, Serena does not return to class. The girls say she'll never be coming back on account of how her mother was arrested for drugs and stuff, and now Serena has to live with her grandmother in Georgia, where, they say, black people are treated like niggers. They say Serena will never stay there. She'll be in trouble in no time talking back to white people. And that's why she said the bad word, Mr. McCourt. With Serena gone, the class changed. A body without a head. Maria raised her hand and asked why I talk funny. Was I married? Did I have any kids? Which did I prefer, Hamlet or Cold Turkey? Why did I become a teacher? They were building bridges where we could travel back and forth. I answered their questions and didn't give a damn anymore about giving them too much information. How many priests had I confessed to when I was the age of these girls? I had their attention, and that was all that mattered. A month after Serena left, there were two good moments. Claudia raised her hand and said, "Mr. McCourt, you're really nice." The class nodded, "Yeah, yeah," and the Puerto Rican boy smiled in the back of the room. Then Maria raised her hand. "Mr. McCourt, I got a letter from Serena. She said this the first letter of her life, and she wouldn't have wrote it but her grandmother told her. She never met her grandmother before, but she loves her because she can't read or write, and Serena reads the Bible to her every night. She said, 'This gonna kill you, Mr. McCourt.' She said she gonna finish high school and go to college and teach little kids. Not big kids like us, because we just a great pain, but little kids that don't talk back. And she said, she's sorry about things she did in this class, and to tell you that, someday she's going to write you a letter." There were fireworks in my head. It was New Year's Eve and the 4th of July,